Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you for tuning in. The website is redice.tv. That's the place where you can find more radio, more videos, and news and everything else that we do. Well, our guest today is Daniel Hammarberg, who returns to the program. He's a native Swede who has written many articles on current events and social issues. He has also worked with the anti-pedophile movement, the network Stop Pedophiles. He's also publicizing their identities, their crimes, and physical whereabouts, of these convicted child molesters. Information, actually, that the Swedish authorities kept hidden. He's also writing, and he's also engaged in various kinds of activism. And as I said, he's been on the show before. It's a pleasure to have you back, Daniel. Thank you so much for coming on again.
Yeah, thanks for the invite. I'm happy to show up.
Very good. If we wanted to just comment a bit on, actually, the Trump victory, because last time we spoke, we did have, of course, a remarkable unfoldment, at least if you ask me. And some of the things that was funny to see was actually some of the consequent attacks on Trump. So I read a thing this morning that, the Trump campaign is surrounding himself by so-called loyalists. You know, they put that in quotation marks. And it was like, I was surprised to see that. It's like, what does the media expect that he's supposed to surround himself with people who have worked against him and who hates him? You know, he's up for quite a task. He needs to position about 2,000 like key positions in, I don't know what he has left now, 65 days or something like that. And just to assume that he can place all these super important people in positions of power that have experience without some of them being former, politicians and lobbyists and this kind of stuff, is quite remarkable. I mean, he needs a little bit of time to replace people and make sure to, clean up the swamp, as I said. But what was your impression of the Trump win, Donnie? How did you perceive it?
Well, it was definitely a surprise. I mean, the polls had shown that Clinton would win, and I have pretty much given up hope. But it was really pleasant to wake up in the morning and see the exit polls coming in and showing that Trump was actually winning. And then to see that there was actually change coming for Washington. So that was really nice to see. But what I really liked about the Trump campaign is that it's formed an anti-establishment movement, a real surge in popular activism and people getting active instead of just sitting complacent like they've been before.
Yeah, exactly. And, I would just urge people to give him a little bit of time as well and not expect, just miraculous changes overnight. I mean, he's already purging some pretty high up people, and a lot of them doesn't want to work with him as well. So the media is going to develop a relationship where they basically insulate him. They literally think, outlets like the Washington Post and these other rags, they literally think that they're defending themselves against Adolf Hitler when they're like criticizing him and stuff like that. So this is going to be fun. It's going to be fun to see how this unfolds and what he'll be able to do. But don't expect, as I said, miraculous changes overnight. Give him a little bit of time. Let's see who he replaces some of the people with. And hopefully he doesn't have too many of the old guard there. But even if he does, I understand it just due to the fact that he needs to put so many people in positions of power first of all. And then we'll see what happens at that point. But we're not here to discuss Trump today, actually, Daniel. We're here to talk about a different subject. You sent me a proposal, which I liked, an outline in terms of the religious kind of dilemma that we face, the history of Christianity in Europe, Judaism, and also kind of coupled that with some of the pre-Christian traditions. But give us an outline of what it is that you wanted to address, Daniel.
Yeah, I think that today Christianity is really not very grounded in history. Like, they've gotten their perspectives from recent Bible editions like the Scofield Bible, and they've been victims of a certain kind of theology called dispensationalism. So I thought I would bring up key points about what Christian history is really like, and there was also a couple of other things I thought I'd bring up, like Semitic religion and how I see it and what I feel is in common between really all Semitic religion that really sets it apart from European religious tradition, which I feel is much more civilized. So
yeah,
I divided the intended show into four different areas that I thought we would discuss. So that's about it.
Very good. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've always been interested in the Semitic religions, not as a practitioner of them, but as a mechanism to try to understand the dilemma that we're in, etc. But I guess we should open with the issue of Judaism versus Christianity, right? That the Christianity we know has a root in Judaism. They're all related, of course, to the Abrahamic religions. But where should we begin, do you think, Daniel?
Yeah, I think the main point is to address the absurdity that Christians, especially in America today, the evangelicals, that they support Israel and believe, even worse, that the Jews are the chosen people when it's so much at odds with Christian tradition. I would like to bring up the fact that from the very first days of Christianity, they felt that Israel, the Christians were the new Israel and had replaced them. The Jews had been shown their Messiah, Jesus, but they had rejected him, and that had made them lose their status as the chosen people, and Christians had become it instead. So that's what I would like to discuss.
Let me just comment on that quick. That's always an interesting take, I think, that Jesus was he was a Messiah for the Jewish people, right? That he was never intended as one for Europeans, right? He was one that's meant to kind of absolve the sins of the Semitic people or something like that. I mean, but the fact that they threw him out or didn't accept him put them in a very different position, right?
Yeah. According to Paul of Tarsus, one of the key figures of early Christianity, Jesus had come first for the Jews, then for the Gentile, but since the Jews rejected him, it became so clear that the Jews were no longer God's chosen people. So something called replacement theology, or the new covenant, was established. According to Christian theology, it was felt that what bonded man and God wasn't the circumcision that the Jews had been taught. Instead, it was the circumcision of the heart. So by circumcising your heart, your spirit, you bonded to God instead of what the Jews did. So that was a very important part of early Christian theology that's really absent today, it seems.
Interesting, yeah, because, I mean, the way the story goes, for those who don't know, it's a quick note on this. When Abraham is 99 years old, he enters into a covenant with this new God that has showed up called Yahweh. And he enters into that covenant by cutting off the foreskin on his penis.
Yeah.
and I mean, okay, you know, that's fine, whatever you want to believe, dude. But that's the originating point of the Abrahamic religions, you know. But that's interesting. So you're saying that instead of like taking things literally or doing them in the physical flesh, etc., these are spiritual principles that are meant to change you, I guess, in some way, right?
Yeah, that was a universal belief from the very first days of Christianity until very recent modern times. Their position on Jews was so consistent. They had rejected Jesus. They had nothing to do with being the chosen people. The Christians were the chosen people through circumcising their hearts. So,
do you know what that means, by the way? I mean, what did they? I haven't heard that before, but does it signify something in particular to quote circumcise your heart?
Really, just to take Jesus as your personal savior and believe that by believing in him you will earn God's blessing and go to heaven.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, but it's a funny, like, when it should have been, or when it really was a consistent and persistent part of Christian theology for so long, it has been abandoned among evangelicals today. You really instead see them say things like the Jews are the chosen people and Israel is the fulfillment of biblical prophecy and such,
right?
Which the church fathers would more or less hang people if they didn't, if they weren't against violence. But it would be so upsetting to them to hear that a supposed Christian would say something like that.
Yeah, we'll get into later, of course, how this kind of changed and what happened along the way, how this image was kind of reversed. Today we have something they call a Judeo-Christian tradition and things like that, and that some others are, you know, synonymous with the West. But yeah, please proceed, Daniel.
Yeah, it really was brought to a collision in Spain in the late 15th century when the Spanish Inquisition started to appear. It was brought about by Jews who had converted to Christianity, but who the Inquisitioners, didn't really feel that they were loyal. So this Torquemada, the Grand Inquisitor Torquemada, he launched this campaign, the Spanish Inquisition, against Jewish influence, and really tried to expunge all such thoughts. So that was how mainstream Christianity viewed the matter. They were really hostile to Judaic influences.
And it was still Catholicism in the majority of the European countries, in Christendom, so to speak, at that point. But you're right, I mean, 1492, a seminal point in Spanish history where they finally, after 700 years of trying to get their country back from the Muslims who had been let in by many of these Jews, these conversos, as they were called, in very powerful positions. Very interesting piece of history right there.
Yeah. And it's so funny, like, how a Christian today can be so ignorant and, like, not wonder why was Torquemada so upset by Jewish influences. And that's not the only one. Relatively modern church father. There's obviously Martin Luther, to the father of Protestantism.
Yeah, tell us more about this, because he's the one who wrote On the Jews and Their Lies, right, Martin Luther?
Yeah, it's a really radical book. I mean, the word anti-Semitism is thrown around a lot, and it almost always means nothing. But when I read that book, for the first time in my life, I did actually got my taste of actual anti-Semitism. Because the things he said about Jews were really horrible. He wanted to run them out of the country, and he basically didn't want them to be left alive and stuff like that. So
was any of his historically, in terms of what he was faced with at that time, I don't know much about the time. I know that he was very upset with the Catholic Church, and I don't know because if that had to do with later influence, I guess, of Judaism in Catholicism or something like that. But he turned against the Catholics primarily. But was any of his, antagonism, was that justified, basically? That's what I'm asking.
I guess with the modern view of Martin Luther, the more secular one, he appears like a bit of a madman, really. The conventional view today is that for the first part of his life, he railed against the Vatican and Catholicism, which he believed oppressed people. And for that part of his life, he was more friendly toward the Jews. But during the later part of his life, then his hostility was directed against Jews instead, and he wrote this book. I mean, the tone.
Do you want to read something from it?
Yeah, like, so you can get a taste of it.
Yeah.
Like this is the one of the first passages in the book. Like, here it is, when he refers to someone who has talked with the Jews. Therefore, a Christian should be content and not argue with the Jews. But if you have to or want to talk with them, do not say any more than this. Listen, Jew, are you aware that Jerusalem and your sovereignty, together with your temple and priesthood, have been destroyed for over 1460 years? For this year, which we Christians write, dear, let the Jews bite on this nut and dispute this question as long as they wish. I mean, the tone of his writing, it's like unbelievable for a church father. So there was such hostility towards Jews.
Yeah, because, recently, they have turned, well, many of the Jews have actually, turned against Protestantism and specifically his founder. They're trying to basically, I guess, I don't know if they want a reformation or something, or if they want an apology, but they did a similar thing with Spain and the Inquisition, going back to 1492, where Spain, gave citizenship to all Sephardic Jews as a way to basically say they're sorry. In that case, I think it's absolutely absurd, to be honest, because of what they faced and what they had to endure for 700 years due to some of their, policies and whatever. What do you know about this most recent one in terms of them turning against the Protestant movement now?
There was, 2 weeks ago, a demand from the Simon Wiesenthal Center to get an apology for Martin Luther's book, Rabbi Abraham Cooper at the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles demanded that from Protestants. It's a funny, this position, this relationship between Jews and Christians, because the evangelicals, their real ideological father is obviously Martin Luther, who had so vehement hatred for the Jews, yet still, because of the Schofield Bible and such influences, there's so much in the pocket of Jews. So it's a funny conflict to witness when you really aren't part of either camp.
Let's talk about that for a little bit, how that happened. I know a little bit about the Schofield Reference Bible, but it's, as you said before, dispensationalism. What happened? How did they turn this around?
It started in the mid-19th century. There were many theological currents in American society. For the first part of American history, it was fire and brimstone and Calvinism. It was thought that basically if you committed any sin, then God would know and he would send you to hell. But towards the later half of the 19th century, it seems another theological current became more dominant. It was called dispensationalism, and it eventually culminated in a Bible called the Schofield Bible, or to use the full name, the Schofield Reference Bible, which portrayed biblical matters in a way much more preferable to Jews. And one can suspect that there may have been Jewish money involved in the production and dissemination of this book, because it has really brought Christianity as a vessel for Jewish influence in American society.
Yeah, it was C.I. Schofield, or Cyrus Ingerson Schofield, that actually wrote this book. And I know that, I forget his first name. This is a guy, I've seen some of his stuff online, Pastor Anderson, he's called. He actually done a movie called The Road to Zion, which is actually pretty good. I mean, he's very, I guess, evangelical. He's not evangelical. He's a Protestant. He's like trying to find the origin point and stuff like that. And he seems to go back more to those, earlier church fathers and kind of believe what they said. And he's even questioned the Holocaust and things like this. But take a look at that, folks, if you want to see more about this chapter and see. Because I believe, I can't recall actually everything from the documentary now, The Road to Zion, but he does go into that Schofield was in some way, influenced, and he had an agenda, and that's why he wrote this book. The question, though, is how did it end up in every, church in America, basically, because it's particularly American Zionism that had been so vehement in pushing this, right?
Yeah, I don't know exactly the particulars, but I know that if you have money to distribute the material with, that's what gets into people's hands. So my theory is that there was Jewish banker money involved, that they looked at the various Christian currents and decided which one would favor them the most. So they encouraged the production and distribution of this Schofield Bible, and that's what has changed the status of Jews so much.
And the Hollywood movies, that's another important point too. I mean, it's like Ben-Hur, the Ten Commandments, and there's a number of these like really, I mean, they're good movies. They're epic, magnificent movies at the time. Cecil B. DeMille, a couple of these other directors that did some of those movies. And that I think has contributed to creating this kind of mythologization around Moses and actually going back more to the Old Testament and favoring that view as opposed to the New Testament, which was more harsh towards the Jews that were considered within the Christian doctrine to have been responsible for the death of Christ, right?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, the move from New to Old Testament stuff in movies. I mean, the movies that were produced weren't so much about Jesus more than they were about Moses. So
yeah,
that's a relatively new feature in Christianity, I believe, that we didn't see in past centuries.
So tell us about the dark side of Judaism.
Yeah, I've researched this a bit, and the Jewish scriptures are very explicit in things that would be appalling to people in general. I mean, today you take for granted that we condemned violence and we condemn child rape and such, but the Talmud is a completely different matter because it actually promotes murder, homicide, and child rape. And yeah, I think I should bring up first how Jesus is presented. Jesus isn't named by name in the Talmud. He is rather called Balaam, but it's considered consensus that those passages are read about him. And
Balaam means demon, right?
it's some old name, but let's see. There's this passage that I'm about to read from Talmud, to be specific, Gittin 57a, that where the Jews supposedly raise Jesus from the dead. I can read right away here.
Yeah.
He then went and raised Balaam by incantations. He asked him, "Who is in repute in the other world?" He replied, "Israel." He then asked, "What is your punishment?" He replied, "With boiling hot semen." So the Talmud says that Jesus is in hell and boiling in hot semen.
Yeah, I've heard excrement or something like that too. I know there's a couple of different versions of that, but it's like just a vicious, horrendous view of Jesus that they have in the Talmud, you know?
Yeah, he's really hated. And the other day too, I saw on a modern day Israeli comedy show where they really picked Jesus apart. They had like a half-naked woman who heckled Jesus, and yeah, the hate against Jesus among Jews is enormous, both back in the Talmudic days and today. So, yeah.
One thing I wanted to add to that too is the genocide that's advocated in the Talmud. I mean, it is in the Old Testament too, to be honest, of like smiting thine enemy and like, you know, eradicate their seed off of the face of the earth forever and these kind of things. It was a pretty interesting book called The Bible for Those Who Hate the Bible, I believe it was. We did a show with him many years ago, and he detailed much of this kind of violence and genocide and eradication of, like, you know, unacceptable people in it, basically. So people usually don't know that, and they look the other way. You know, it's kind of like saying that Islam is a religion of peace. It's like, yeah, right.
I think that the Old Testament has really made its way into Christianity by accident. My personal view, though it's critical of Christian orthodoxy, but I feel that really Christianity is a Greek philosophy. It's based in Hellenism, those philosophies that were in circulation back 2,000 years ago in Greece. And it just happened that I believe that the reason is that Paul of Tarsus attempted to get the Jews to be more conforming with Roman values. So I believe he invented this religion out of Greek philosophy and tied it to the Old Testament and Hebrew beliefs.
Did you say Paul did that?
Yeah, so Paul of Tarsus, the one who is the main character in the book of Acts.
Yeah, I think that's Paul of Tarsus. Is that the same one? Saint Paul. Yeah, exactly. So what happened too, though, that we should recognize is there is a tremendous amount of borrowing when the Bible comes together. I mean, even, you know, from being in captive in Babylon to Egypt, later, of course, contact, as you said, with Greece and these kinds of things. There's a long period of time where if you actually go back in the in the mythological record and do what's called comparative mythology, you realize that much of the Bible, at least the Old Testament, is very much borrowed on other mythological stories, like even, Gilgamesh, there's a certain tie over there in the creation myth and these kinds of things. I think even the Talmud was actually, it's called, I believe, the Babylonian Talmud, because it was like, rising out of that environment while they were, you know, in Babylon. So it's not as cut and dry that they just sat down, as you say, and just, you know, wrote this up or this happened or whatever. There's other involvement from the Romans as well. So Josephus Flavius,
the historian,
is a very important role in this. Josephus Flavius, he was adopted into the Flavian dynasty. He was Jewish himself, but he was adopted into the dynasty because it was so favored. And I know that there's, number of scholars that believe that he was very much responsible for actually bringing this together as well. They've wanted to invent, you know, that the Romans sacked the temple. Was it in 70 AD, I believe, or something like that? And they, before that, they had actually attempted to try to quell the Jewish rebellious spirit. They turned on the Romans all the time. They're very difficult to control. So some believed that Christianity was like invented for the Jewish people to basically to control them, to make them sure that they, I guess, turned the other cheek and became reflective inwards or something like that. But it's a very interesting history here, and it's not as cut and dry as people think, you know?
Yeah, I definitely agree there that the Christianity was created to quell the Jewish people, but it really went the other way. It really never penetrated the Jews.
No.
So but when one looks at the Old Testament in the Bible, one shouldn't think of that as really something written for Christians. It's the Hebrew heritage that only the Jews really support, even though fundamentalist Christians really have to claim that it leads up to Jesus and such, because they feel that otherwise their theology falls apart. But anyway, what I would like to bring up is these Holocaust or extermination commandments in the Old Testament that mm-hmm. lead to the one in the Talmud. And there's in Judaism a list called the 613 commandments, which they often pretend to be like everyday wisdom commandments, like love your neighbor and stuff, but really the contents are completely different. One is a group of commandments, the ones negatively formulated, 17 through 21, that tell Jews to hate Christians. I can read the explicitly or verbatim. They read like this: not to love someone who leads you to idols, not to relax your aversion to them, not to save their lives, not to plead for them, as such. The one behind it, Moses Maimonides, one of the greatest scholars of Judaism, he wrote in other texts that those minim that he referred to, the idolaters, that they really are Christians. So
oh, really?
what these commandments are telling people, the Jews, or that they should hate Christians. Hmm. Yeah, so it's really controversial.
When did he, by the way, I'm looking at this now as you're talking about the Maimonides, I guess, the rabbi that you're talking about. When did he write this, do you know?
Late 12th century. So
okay, so it's fairly late. Okay,
yeah.
Interesting.
So, and the worst part are the ones, the commandments to exterminate people, positive commandments, 186, 187, and 188. 186 is based on Deuteronomy chapter 13, where you're told that if someone dissents in Israel, you have to kill every man, woman, and child, and all the cattle there, and burn down their city, and never let it rise again. And it's part of a Jewish tradition, but I don't think they would actually do it just because a single Jew dissents. But
right.
What's more relevant is 187, which is exterminating the seven nations of Canaan, which many Jews feel is relevant even today. And the obvious victim and target are the Palestinians. So I guess I should read the actual commandment. To destroy, I can try the Hebrew too. Labad Shiva Amamim Mevetz Israel.
No.
To destroy seven nations from the land of Israel. That was what Jews were commanded to do. And this late in the Middle Ages, it was actually repeated by this Maimonides, and it's part of Judaism today. And then there's the third extermination commandment, too, the one about Amalek, 188. I guess I should read the Hebrew again. L'chrit sa'o shel Amalek. To exterminate the seed of Amalek.
I didn't know you spoke Hebrew.
I know how to read the script. Anyway, Amalek is the traditional enemy of the Jews, and they met this people, the Amalekites, in Exodus chapter 17, and from then on it's been their duty to exterminate these people, yet still never forget about them because they were so...
And I know that there's been interpretations of like who is who in the Bible, right? Who's the Zadokites, who's the Zealots, who's the Amalekites, who's the, you know, Canaanites, etc., and all that kind of stuff. But what should be remembered is that there's a ton of these super derogatory kind of terms, Goyim, of course, being one of them. But it's this general view that if you're not a Jew, you're basically like an animal. You're like an outsider. You're not let into. You're not the part of the important group, basically, which is reminiscent of this idea of the chosen people. And this is something which is concurrent throughout Judaism. And although it's not maybe highlighted and spoken about today, there are some rabbis that still continue to this day to kind of speak in those terms. And they see the outsiders as an enemy of the Jewish people, basically.
Yeah, I don't think the Jews ever became universalistic like we Europeans were. They've always been xenophobic and ethnocentric. And this Amalek commandment is really scary because they are a bit subjective in how they interpret whether someone is an Amalekite. I mean, if you read the Bible, it would appear to be a historical people that they met on the way into their promised land. But Jews interpreted basically any enemy, like Nazis and whatever, as Amalekites.
Ah, I see.
So, I mean, I've read many statements by modern-day Jews, and whenever they come across someone standing in their way or harassing them or whatever, they describe it as that they've had an encounter with Amalek. So when this commandment to exterminate this seed, basically kill every last one of Amalek, it's quite scary that they feel they have the privilege to identify Amalek a bit here and there. You kind of wonder whether the genocide that occurred in Russia, if this view of Amalek played any part, like maybe Jews were influential and they identified opponents as Amalek. And
interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting point, you know, because we don't know what religiously some of these people think and if they are considering still that this is an enemy. And this is a common trait of many religions too, to kind of have this view, of course. But yeah, actually on Wikipedia, they've moved these down, which is interesting. So if you do search for 613 commandments and try to find the number that Daniel just referenced, they've moved them further down. I don't know if that's intentional or not, but for example, from 596 and onwards, you have these, like destroy the seven Canaanite nations. 597, not to let any of them remain alive. 598, wipe out the descendants of Amalek. 599, remember what the Amalek did to the Jewish people. 600, not to forget Amalek's atrocities and ambush on our journey from Egypt in the desert. 601, not to dwell permanently in Egypt. Anyway, it goes on from there. Not to offer peace with Ammon and Moab, that's other kind of groups and people. So there's a lot of hostility and anger in these guys, you know?
Yeah, I believe that basically Judaism is a religion of hate and paranoia. There's not much else really in Judaism.
There's a Jewish guy, actually, who did some research. He was funded by Freemasons, interestingly enough. He actually has it in the beginning of his book. DMT, The Spirit Molecule, is a book from the year 2000. His name is Rick Strassman. And he, you know, wrote a whole treatise on this, and they've been, you know, studying this or whatever. His follow-up book was called DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, which basically went into this idea that it's very long-winded, but his research kind of points to the fact that, you know, when you die, you release DMT, which is what he calls the spirit molecule, as a way to kind of tap into a different dimension. It's kind of like a natural form of LSD almost. But he wrote a second book on the Soul of Prophecy, and he theorized that many of the church fathers, or those in the old, not the church fathers, but the Old Testament, actually, you know, suffered from certain ailments that actually had this release of DMT. So he says, obviously, he says it's a good thing, and this is the way they could, like, you know, talk to Yahweh or tap into certain, you know, spiritual, you know, disciplines or principles or stuff like that. But there seems to be an element of the fact that many of them suffered from kind of like schizophrenia and these kinds of things. And if you exclude the DMT portion of it and you know, or just look at it clinically and medically, you could argue that some of these people, if it's true, that they were suffering from some kind of issue with their brain, basically. And wouldn't that be interesting if that is true, that at the, like, the origin point of, you know, of these early characters in the Old Testament basically had some damn brain issue. How about that?
I know actually something interesting. Have you heard of the bicameral theory?
Sure, but, of course. Yep. Bicameral mind. Yep.
Yeah, that's his thesis. The guy who wrote that theory was that before 500 BC or so, people had basically been psychotic, had believed that they had actually heard voices, and they had no really conscious reasoning, but they only followed voices in their heads. So it's really present in the Bible, this perspective.
Yeah, Julian Jaynes, we have actually talked about him in many older shows, psychologists, which is kind of interesting because it could point to some kind of more instinctual type of consciousness that existed if you go way back. And then at some point that started to change and it became, you know, a very cognitive, our cognitive abilities became different. Our self-awareness became different and we started to operate on a different level. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it could all be tied in. It's actually very interesting. But I think we should move along before we get too long-winded here, Daniel.
Yeah. Initially, I had like a long list of religious things I had pondered, like philosophy more like, but let's see what I had written. Was going to bring up some stuff about sexuality in the Talmud. Christianity is sometimes attacked for being supposedly misogynistic, and it's argued that Christianity brought the oppression of women and such. But what I would like to bring up is, to the extent that that is true, it is really in its Hebrew heritage. Because if you read the New Testament, it's really complete equality for women. But in the Old Testament, in the Jewish Bible, it's completely different. I mean, the Jewish law in the Torah permits keeping slave women and taking slave women. I mean, marriage in the Old Testament isn't really at all like our modern marriage. Actually, in the Talmud specifically, marriage is understood oftentimes to be initiated by a man raping a woman. And
really?
Absurdly, yeah. And in the Talmud, especially in the book called Nida, it's covered, and in Nida 44b it's brought up that a woman of the age of 3 can actually become a wife by raping her. That's
right.
Judaism. It's so absurd. I can read that. Let's see now. Mishnah: a girl of the age of 3 years and 1 day may be betrothed by intercourse. If the Yabam had intercourse with her, he acquires her thereby. The guilt of adultery, it's them in that book there, they discuss this, but they don't discuss the morality of raping 3-year-olds and making them your women, but rather listen to this, the odd stuff that is brought up directly afterwards. Our rabbis thought a girl of the age of 3 years may be betrothed by intercourse, but the sages say only one who is 3 years and 1 day old. What is the practical difference between them? So, like, when they brought up this serious point, raping 3-year-olds and making them wives, the rabbis rather discuss whether there's a difference if they're exactly 3 years old or 3 years and 1 day.
It's this literal thing as well, which I find hilarious. It's this, like, and you get that with scripture, right? Because the idea also is that this is the word of God, right? It comes to you as, you know, inspired scripture. It's text that came from a higher source and these early channelers, if you will. And we're back to that DMT kind of schizophrenia thing again, that you're talking with something else or you're hearing voices or you're just getting messages from somewhere. We basically could be looking at an early development of a subconscious or that we had a subconscious. And then as the human species develop, we move into a more of a conscious mind, right? The bicameral theory again. So anyway, it could mean that this is coming from somewhere else. Maybe it's an inner voice, but they believe it's God or something. Some of the stuff with the ego and some of these complexes that you struggle with through development as a child and stuff like that comes through in this development. But anyway, my point is, I think that they take it so literal because they don't question the material itself, right? So instead of like questioning the sentence or the concept behind the sentence or the scripture. As you say, they begin to bicker about maybe the details of what did that word then mean? Or does it mean 1 day and two and and 3 years old, or just 3 years old, and it's quite absurd, isn't it? I mean, that they go to such an extent to break down every damn sentence, but not question the message or as you say, the morality behind the sentence.
Yeah, morality is completely absent in the Talmud. I mean, when the Talmud is like 10,000 pages all in all, and you would think that a people would have acquired a lot of philosophical and ethical thinking. The Greeks certainly did, but in Jewish tradition, it's so absent. I think it speaks of a fundamental difference between European peoples and Semitic ones, because the latter seems to lack many of the things that we take for granted, like morality and ethics.
Yeah, I mean, remember the story of Hanukkah as well. I mean, it's based on slaughter of Syrian Greeks, you know, with the Maccabees and all that kind of stuff. A lot of the celebrations, too, within Judaism has to do with a violent overthrow of a power, or they managed to turn something around and you know, and usually, of course, they take a position that they were the victims all the time. I think most groups do that. They're not managed to have an objective view on things. But that's one example of a horrendous story. Look into the origins of Hanukkah. We actually did a video that went into this when over Christmas last year, which is very good. And we broke that down in terms of what actually Hanukkah means and what it means when they light the menorah and all these kind of things. And it's like it's based on genocide. You know, it's amazing.
Yeah. Then there's Pesach, the Easter festival too, and it's based obviously on. And the firstborn in Egypt getting slaughtered. And then there's Purim, where this Haman character plots against them, but they kill him and all his followers instead, and they celebrate that slaughter. So it's a really vicious religion.
Yep, we should do a official outreach to Trump. I don't know if some of his Jewish people around him will allow it, unfortunately, but we should do an outreach to him and say, take down the menorah that is put up on the White House lawn every year and actually erase a Christmas tree instead. You know, because he was talking about bringing back Christmas. He was actually talking about that. He hated the PC kind of thing that you have to call it holidays in America. And we actually have done the same in Sweden, where they say God helg instead of God jul, you know, good Yule celebration, which is interesting. So it's very PC. But anyway, what else do we have left here in the first portion that we should get into, Daniel?
It's an observation I made. I mean, many Christians say that they've been saved and they've been baptized, and then they pretend that they're in it for life, that if you get separated from your community, your religion stays with you. But an interesting observation I made is when an individual is actually separated from his community, his religious community, he quickly loses the religions he was supposedly saved into. I mean, in India, you know, when the East India Company took their business to India, then there were many English Christians who went there for that business. Before they had went, they had been practicing Christians, but when they were in their new country, most of them actually took new religions. It's interesting to see how actually it works with religion. It's really community-based Christianity. I mean, if you don't have a community, then a religion like Christianity is irrelevant, because it's not something you're born into like Judaism or such. It's only about the community.
Interesting. Well, that kind of scares me too about the fact that we've had a very long-lasting pre-Christian tradition. It was disrupted violently with Christianity, a top-down imposement. We had Christianity for a while. It came in the last in the Scandinavian countries, maybe the Baltic countries, to be honest, because it was actually a crusade against some of the Baltic countries from Scandinavia in the early first millennium, unfortunately, I'm sad to say. So they might be the one that actually was last Christianized. But anyway, Scandinavia was very late in the process Christianized. And it was also almost one of the first countries where it started to go out the window. You know, we've turned more to atheism and scientificism and these kinds of things. And we're left very, you know, without a tradition, without that type of spiritual anchoring and a culture. And that's why it scares me with Islam coming into our country, Daniel, because it, you know, what if people are attracted to it because it's simply a it fulfills a very base need of a simple ritual behavior. And we've already started to see people go in that direction. I would hope that people would turn to the pre-Christian tradition instead. What do you think about that?
I think, sadly, one would say that such religions, community-based religions like Christianity and Islam, are a superior concept to all pre-Christian religion. Such community-based religions will always defeat them. So,
I think, our pre-Christian traditions, they were extremely community-oriented. It was all
But this evangelizing, it is intolerant evangelizing religion that Christianity brought about. Yeah. I think that's has been a tremendously superior concept that has defeated anything else.
Yeah, it's a damn shame. People look back into your past because there's a lot of things. Regular listener to this show, they know this, but for new listeners that might be tuning in and everything else, we've done a lot of shows on our pre-Christian, pre-European, not pre-European, but ancient European traditions, I should say. And there's a ton of material there, very exciting things. And when some people learn it and connect with those things and really, touch with that again, they literally do have an awakening of sorts, and they connect with something which is, far older than these foreign religions that pushed into our country. I see basically what's happening right now with Islam. It's a little bit of a different, imposement, but I'm seeing it in similar ways. When I see the rise of Islam in a country like Sweden and all European countries for that matter, I see that in the same way that Christianity came in. It's a top down thing. It's brought in by the elite and our political class. No one on the ground, none of the Swedish people are very few are calling for this religion to come into our lands and occupy it. So I think people should return back and connect back with the older ones, as it's the only one that's going to be able to resist the new incoming one. Anyway, what else should we discuss here towards the end of the first segment, Daniel?
I was mostly going to bring up this remarkable religion called Christianity and try to understand the concept or the fundamentals that made it so successful. And what I think is that it has addressed the needs of both the people and their need for community and the urge to be feel like they've been saved, and still address also the functions of the state, like expecting people to pay taxes and such. The reason why Christianity has been so successful is because it has both addressed all these needs and also had all the intolerance of its Hebrew heritage. So right. I think this commandment, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me," combined with Greek philosophy, is what has made Christianity such a success.
And also the timing, because it's still at a time when people are very superstitious for different reasons, right? I mean, there's old Scandinavian traditions, which, some of the scientists, when they discovered this in Sweden, they were amazed by it. But it was like people had been carrying around a big log. I forget what they actually called it, but it was a face carved into kind of like a totem. But it was kind of, he was a mix between the Greek god, I think it's Chernanos or something. It's like a corn god, not corn, it's called like a seed, right? The things that you plant and everything else. It was a god that was meant to give good harvest, basically. And there's places in Sweden where people walked around with this, with this totem and prayed to the seed to get good harvest and these kinds of things. If you had certain portions, of a century or something like that, or a decade, where you have bad harvest, the religious elite could use this against the people. So they could say, for example, well, you're starving now because you've not obeyed God, right? You've done certain things against God. You have to start praying to this new God and this Christian one. Otherwise, you and your family will starve. Your community will starve. You won't be a good harvest. I mean, today it's so different because we have, some scientific development, we have a better understanding of things. So I think it came in at a time when things started to change already, and people were still very superstitious. And if there was a god that was like more powerful, if you will, than another, and if you had a priest class that could manipulate people in that way, we were doomed, is there a connection with nature here? You're saying that there's that this replicates life forms in nature, isn't that right?
Yeah, I think religions, they function. I think the academic term that has been used earlier is memes. Before it became pictograms, it was actually ideas that were floating around and who survived based on whether they were successful or not. And I believe religions like Christianity function exactly like seeds in nature. If they're able to survive and make sure they survive, then they become successful. So the ones we have today are the ones that had what it took to survive, just like seeds in nature. And to do that, you obviously have to foster your own survival and do that at the exclusion of other religions. So that's why I think that the intolerance Christianity inherited from Judaism really served it successfully.
Very interesting. We're going to take a break here, ladies and gentlemen, then we'll continue more in the second hour with Daniel Hammarberg. We're going to talk more about Judaism and National Socialism. This is pretty interesting. We're also going to talk about the Semitic religion in general. There's much more to go into here. But Daniel, before we take a break, please, you know, give us your website. We've done a couple of other interviews in the past that people can tune into that I recommend. But you do have a book out there about Swedish society. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, my website is danielhammarberg.com or danielhammarberg.com. You probably will require a link to see it because you probably will forget it even if I capitalize. But I've got two main personal websites, one.com, English one, and one.se, spelled the same way for my Swedish one. And then there's the book, The Madhouse, A Critical Study of Swedish Society, that I wrote a few years back with my observation of and research about this society. If you really want to get another view of Sweden that is different from what you might hear from a university professor, then I really recommend my book. It's really critical.
Yeah, exactly. It's very good. We started talking about those things, not at the same time, but I'm saying we started, I think, developing very similar sentiments about Swedish society. So when we did our first show together, we spoke a lot about that, which is very important, of course. We're specifically for an American audience, I want to try to, where, as you say, the university professors are praising the Nordic model and the socialists, you know, kind of aspects. And I'm not totally against some aspect maybe of, you know, a socialism that considers what is best for the people. But my point has always been, look at Swedish society now and where it's led us. And it's kind of the fruits of our policies that have gotten us to where we are with equality and all this other BS. So yeah, that's a very important book, ladies and gentlemen. Do check it out. We're going to have the links up to Daniel's website and a link to the book as well. One more thing I want to mention here before we wrap up for the first segment is basically, you know, the member section. That's where you can hear the second hour coming up, redicemembers.com. Do get yourself a membership with us. That's the best way to support us. We have over 1,000 radio shows. We have, you know, our live TV show that we're doing now every almost every weekend called Weekend Warrior. We do videos, we have films, and a bunch of other stuff there for you. So definitely check out a subscription and acquire one. It's only €6 per month. That's about $6.50 US right now, so it's not too much. And we have subscriptions going from 3 months up to 2 years. It's redicemembers.com. Also, one more note, we're doing the NPI live coverage this Saturday, November 19th. Don't miss it. It's going to be a lot of fun. A lot of speakers are going to be there. We're going to stream those to you. We're also going to cover you know, some of the attendees, have some interviews with them. We're going to talk with some of the speakers after they've done their talks and stuff like that. So definitely tune in. We're going to start at 10 a.m. Eastern time. That is 4 p.m. Central European time on Saturday, the 19th. It's redice.tv for more. And also, of course, the same on redicemembers.com. So tune into that. But we'll take a short break here. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. We'll talk to you on the other side of this break.